Okay, Revelation chapter 13, verse 16 and 17. Looking at the signs of the times, the financial signs of the times in which we live. Here's what is written for us. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. And then the last verse of course talks about if you have discernment, if you have wisdom, you'll be able to know what that is, because the number of the name of the beast adds up to what? 666, which has been the devil's number, I guess, since John wrote this. And we've had more beasts run across the paths of human history than you can even shake a stick at. Everyone from Adolf Hitler to Ronald Reagan. People who have added up their names and attributed numbers to letters and figured out who all these guys were and stuff like that. And every time they've been wrong. And they probably will be wrong. I would think that most of them, most people who like to do that will probably not even be aware that the final one, the real one, when he comes on, they'll probably just miss him and think, no, he's not the beast, he's Messiah, according to what the Bible says. But what is he talking about here? He's talking, and you'll notice that the inference here is that he's going to, the false prophet, under the control of the beast, is going to, or the Antichrist, that's the beast, the Antichrist is going to make everybody take upon himself a special mark. And in order to trade, to buy, to sell, to do anything financially, economically, they have to have this mark. And if they do not carry the mark, then they cannot function within the final system. This again ties to the fact, bless you, that we're talking about something more than just a localized economy, are we not? Because it is all who will take this mark. The point that I want to share with you tonight in looking at this sign, if you will, is that we find ourselves at a place where global technology has advanced to the point that what John wrote about is not just a possibility, but is happening to you right now. If you think about the technology that we find ourselves in, it is really incredible. When I was a teenager, there was a war going on, and I think we have some veterans of that war, the Vietnam War. And we thought things were moving pretty quickly then, because for the first time, you almost had the war in your living rooms. I think it was like a 5 to 7 day delay, the footage that they got to. We come to the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, and not only was it real time, they actually showed us on TV where the bombers were flying over, the X marked the spot, and the hit. We just got back from being overseas. It's an amazing thing to me. They knew where I was. When I, you have your little smartphone, which I really am believing is a lot smarter than, well, I know it's smarter than I am. But this is a computer which has more power. How many ever, anybody have a Commodore computer? Remember those? Anybody work with data processing when you had the punch card computers? I had to work on that when I was in college. I had no idea what I was doing, but the guy stuck me in there. I'm punching these things, they're coming out. I don't know if I messed up his business or not. But that punch card computer would only do, would punch out the cards and stuff, and sit in this big room with this big machine. That punch card computer could not touch what this little thing in my hand does right now. And with this little thing in my hand, when we would cross into different borders, we went into Ireland, I got this little message saying, "Welcome to Ireland, you now have access on your phone. Welcome to Great Britain, you now have access on the phone. Welcome back to the United States." Okay? You think they knew where I was? I wonder if they know where I am right now. Hello? You don't know. But we have the technology to do that. Anybody buy a house in the 1980s? Remember buying a house in the 1980s? Appraisal time, approval time. Probably no less than 2 weeks. Going through all your financials, going through all your backgrounds, making sure everything's approved, the assessment, all this stuff. How long does it take to be approved for a house right now? You understand? It doesn't even take an hour. It's almost instantaneous. They know when you call. They know when they punch it in. They may not talk to you for an hour, but they know. stores know what you buy, because you get 10 cents off a gallon of gasoline by using their card to tell them what you bought. See the incentive there? They know what you buy because most of us do not use cash anymore. We use cards. And our cards track what we buy. Those cards have more, again, more intelligence than some little calculators that we used to use. It's an incredible time that we live in. The information. Can you imagine that all your information is on the back of a little card? That all they got to do is, how's that work? All they got to do, you've seen these. I know you have these. They just stripe that little thing right there, and they know who you are. They know how much money you have. They know how much money you can access. They know all that about you. Okay? I can't even imagine that John had any concept of anything like this. I mean, a plastic card with a stripe on the back that instantaneously tells them everything about you financially. Okay? One of the signs that John told us would happen is we would enter into a time where technology would make it possible that you could control the masses on the earth, even to the point that they could not buy, sell, or trade, or do anything except for they carried upon themselves the mark of the beast. Now, this is an interesting concept, too. This is not the only mark that is written about in the book of Revelation. If you remember, when the 144,000 are sealed of God, they are sealed and placed upon their forehead is a mark of God. That is a seal of identity. It is also, I believe, a seal of protection that God puts upon them. But with the mark of the beast, what does it say? Either on the forehead or upon the hand. What is this mark? Is it a visible mark? Is it an identifying mark? I don't know that I believe that all of us are going to be walking around, not us anyway, but the ones who have, are going to be walking around with a tattoo on their forehead. I know you've seen some of the movies that do that and read the books where you got these stripes down their foreheads and stuff. They don't have to do that. Technology allows for them to monitor where your dog's at and where your dog is not at. There are some people that have actually put some of these chips within their own children because of the threat of kidnapping and things like that. You know, there's always a benevolent reason for invading a person's privacy. You understand that? Always a benevolent reason, okay? There is the convenience factor, and we don't want to be inconvenienced for anything. So we want something that happens rapidly, and we've been nurtured that way. Your computers again. We have to have computer information when? 3 seconds before we ask for it. Because if it took 20 seconds, all you have to do is sit around my office, and Donna knows this. If that thing freezes up, we got problems. Did yours freeze up? Mine froze up. When you remember when computers come out, if they did it in a few minutes, we thought, this is amazing. We have the technology. The first sign that I want to give you that we are warned about by the prophet is the technology. And I'm not even dealing with the mark of the beast and that so much right now. But the technology to do what John foresaw could be done. And not in a regional sense, but in a global sense. Where you could have an agency that could tell where you are, what you spend, everywhere from everything that you do, and particularly when it comes to the economic thing. What would happen, just suppose, what would happen if the bank suddenly jumped to that system and said tomorrow, if you're not in the system, if you do not acquiesce to the system, we're going to take your money away. Could they take your money? Think about it this way. In our system, how much real money is actually used? How much real money is actually used? How much real money is actually, when you get a loan for a house, let's say your house is $300,000, does anybody ever go get $300,000, carry it over the lending agent and say, here Tony, here's $300,000, now we're going to watch you as you take this $300,000 to the bank and put it on your mortgage? Most of our funds are actually electronic now. The technology is there. So the first sign that we have is this sign that John told us about 2,000 years ago. The ability to track everybody, the ability to monitor everybody, and the ability to control everybody's spending. And unless they carried upon themselves the identifying mark of the head of the final world system, that's the mark of the beast, okay? If they have not submitted themselves to the authority of the beast, then they cannot buy, sell, or trade. In other words, they're put out. And eventually, you know what happens. They'll be put to death because they will be seen as rebels and they will be seen as those who stand against the will of the potentate of that day, and they will be seen as a black mark upon society itself. You don't want to fit in? You don't want to give in? You don't want to submit? Then we're going to take everything you have because we can. And not only that, we're going to eventually take your life. First sign that is given to us is this sign of technology that tells us we are already in a time where this could happen on a global scale. All right, the second sign. Look in Revelation again, and let's go to chapter 6 in verse 5 and 6. Now, if you know me, I personally believe that these seals themselves will not be broken until Antichrist comes. But Antichrist will step into many things that are already moving. The technology is already moving. These signs are already happening even before he comes. But here's a picture of what the world is going to be look like in this time. Revelation chapter 6, verse 5 and 6. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat it had a pair of scales in his hand. What are scales used for? Measuring, weights. It's an economic picture, okay? And I heard the voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "A quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine." Well, let's see what he's saying here. Verse 6, he said, a quart of wheat for a denarius. Different evaluation on that. The clearest one I get is a denarius is about a day's wages. You say, it's not an exact amount, it's a day's wages for whatever time period you're in. So, can you imagine a quart of wheat for a day's wages is how they describe it. What does that speak to you? It speaks to you of the cost of just the basics going through the roof. It speaks to us about a widening gap between prosperity and poverty. I believe that even when we move into this time period, there will always be those who have an exorbitant amount. But I do think what he begins to speak to us here is it's going to be more and more difficult to remain in the area that most of us find ourselves in right now, which would be the middle class. Okay? The prices of things, that is just the things that we need to sustain life, will go through the roof. It'll be difficult for people to acquire these things. It will certainly be difficult for everyday people to acquire these things. You can see how you could have the necessity of again, regional or worldwide co-op system, where eventually we'd say, you know what, we're hungry, we've got to eat and stuff. So they say, well, if you will, go back to chapter 30, if you will take the mark of the beast, we will make sure that you have all the food you need. This socialist mentality that our country, if you think about, fought against for decades. It used to be a terrible thing to speak of socialism. It used to be a terrible thing to speak of a government that has control of everything under the sun. Now it seems to be the desired thing. You know, you've got a bunch of people not working, not taking a shower, sitting outside of banks and stuff like this, complaining that they don't have anything to eat. Pushing us to the thought that that we need to move to this socialistic system. But what they don't understand, see, they're all mad at the Wall Street guys for all the money that they're making and stuff. And again, I want you to think about this economically. But what they're willing to do is they're willing to take that same wealth, have the government take control of that wealth, and they don't realize you're still going to have a small few controlling everything and then doling it out to the poor, pitiful masses as that small few determine is best for everybody. And think about that. We fought against that. We stood against that. We understand that it does nothing to raise up the... Look at history. It does nothing to raise up humanity. It does nothing but make this you know, robotic working class that sees no opportunity to excel. When did excellence become such a curse word? When did you know, some of the most benevolent people that I met in my life are people that have got out there, got ahead, and then shared with other people. And not because the government put a crowbar in their wallet and says, we're going to take this from you and make you give this money to people who will not work. Where's the virtue in not working, in sitting outside a building and complaining about not working and then saying, but those people who do work, we want their money. Where's the virtue in that? But this is what the world is being turned upside down by this. Okay? And as things get worse and as things get harder, as food becomes more scarce, okay? Again, that void, that... you know, that opportunity for someone to step in and say, hey, I got a better idea. But it's not new. It's not going to be a new idea. It's not going to be a better idea. I really believe that the dumbing down of America has allowed us to get to this place. You know, I just got to tell you something from my perspective that gives me an idea of where we're heading. Has anybody ever played a game with me?
Yes.
Card game, board game, basketball game, golf game. I'm going to tell you, I'm not the best at basketball, I'm not the best at golf. But I don't act like it. And when I play card games, I play to what? To win. I was brought up that there was virtue in excelling. And not to win at all costs, but to win properly. And there was nothing shameful about winning. But somehow we're teaching our kids now there's something shameful. When my son was playing t-ball, at the end of the season, you know, you move into the little league thing, and everybody gets a trophy. Well, if everybody gets a trophy, what's a trophy worth? Can you answer that? Nothing. If everybody's a winner, you know, everybody's a winner. Well, that's not true. Everybody's not a winner. But we have made it something horrible that someone wins and someone loses. But I guarantee you some of the most profound lessons we've all learned is when we have not come out ahead and we learn something from that. And hopefully we grow from that. We're moving to this time where mentally we've lost all sense of excellence. We've lost all reason, and in some cases it's being taken away from us. There's no reason to get ahead, because if you get ahead, what's the government going to do? It's going to take it from you. Okay? These are very troubling times. And what you need to see here is what we will see is this continual widening gap between prosperity and poverty. Until the end of the age, there will always be the elite, guarantee you. Always. But clearly the numbers that will be on the bottom half will be the majority. The destruction of the middle class in our country is just a picture of what's happening worldwide. It's just a picture. And I would say too that the middle class has been what has been economically what has been stabilizing our country for all of its history. All right, second sign, that widening gap. And he talks about it right here. There will always be people who will have money to get, you know, the wheat and stuff, and it won't be a big thing to them. But the majority of people will not be able to. It will be a hardship to them. The third sign. Go back to the book of Ezekiel. Let's look what another prophet had to say. Ezekiel chapter 38. And as you're turning there, I want to remind you something that's very important when we talk about prophecy. I don't think you can understand prophecy or end time prophecy if you want to be one of those people who remove Israel from God's prophetic picture. Those who teach replacement theology, that Israel has no need to exist today, but the church has replaced Israel and God's prophetic thing, they have a real problem theologically. Okay? And even when Jesus talked about in Matthew chapter 24 and 25, when he talked about just prior to his coming, what it would be like, every geographical reference in there has to do with Israel. Doesn't say anything about New York City. Doesn't say anything about America. Matter of fact, you'd be hard-pressed to find America, this great nation that we are, in the Scripture at all. Not even by inference you would have a hard time. You know, so the center of God's prophetic plan is Israel. You know where the center of the earth is? Anybody know where the center of the earth, where all directions biblically are determined from? Jerusalem. The north, the south, the east, and west, prophetically. Jerusalem is the center point. It's the city of the great king. Guess where he's coming back when he comes back? To Jerusalem. Say, the Mount of Olives, Pastor, is what I read. Where do you think the Mount of Olives is? It's in Jerusalem. Okay? So, Ezekiel chapter 38 tells us something that's going to happen. And I would encourage you to read the whole chapter, 38 and 39. They're intriguing. But here, I just want to reference a couple verses, starting with verse 10, and here's what he said. Thus said the Lord God, on that day it shall come to pass that the thoughts will rise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. Well, who is the evil plan and who has the thoughts rise in their mind? You read earlier and you find out he's talking about Gog and Magog. He is talking about Rosh and Meshach. He's talking about Tubal. He's talking about these countries. He's going to talk about Ethiopia, and he's going to talk about Persia. He's going to talk about all these countries that are literally surrounding where? Israel. Okay? Anybody know the modern name of Persia?
Iran.
Okay? So he speaks that. He's going to talk about Libya. He's going to talk about Put, which is the Ethiopian area. He's going to talk about all these people. And he says that the Lord God on that day shall come past, the thoughts will arise in your mind. The enemies of God, the enemies of God's people will rise in your mind, and you will make an evil plan. You will say, I will go up against the land of unwalled cities. Now, why is that term, unwalled cities, significant? Well, think of the day that Ezekiel wrote this. In that day, every city that was a city and considered to be a city was built with walls around it. The ancient city of Jerusalem, you go there even today, right? There's still walls around the ancient city. But look at what it says. At this time, there will be unwalled cities. Jerusalem doesn't look the same way today as it did in Ezekiel's day. You don't put walls up anymore. Walls wouldn't do you any good in that sense. There's no protection, you know, from invading forces from walls like it was in that day when they had primitive weapons. Okay? So it says, you will go against the land of unwalled city, and I will go to a peaceful people who dwell safely, and all of them dwelling without walls and have neither bars or gates, to take plunder, to take booty, to stretch out your hand against the waste places that are again inhabited, and against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and good and who dwell in the midst of the land. Verse 12 speaks of Israel. If you go over there today and you talk to some of the guys who were historians, and they talk about Israel pre-1948, it was a wasteland. It wasn't any different than when you go into Jordan and Egypt. And I'm going to tell you, if you're in Israel and you go into Jordan, Egypt, Syria, or Lebanon, you know that you've stepped into another world. We went to Egypt this time, and Cal warned me about that. He said, you will not like Cairo. And we were okay with Jordan. Jordan was not quite as advanced as Israel. But I've never been any place like Egypt. You're right. I think you told me it had 6 million people in one trash can. That's true. You cannot believe buildings that were, I think, 12 stories or 20 stories. Can't remember the number of stories. Tall, okay? You could live on the 18th to the 20th story, and I want to tell you, you have no plumbing. You have no running water. We're talking about buildings that have just been built all throughout Cairo. Okay? Look at how Ezekiel describes Israel, though. Israel had been abandoned, which it had. For almost 2,000 years, the Jewish people were, for the most part, out of Israel. I believe by the providence of God in 1948, God allowed them to come back. The same people, as he described, who've been scattered everywhere. But notice how he describes them in verse 20. It said, verse 12, excuse me. Stretch out your hand, the waste places that are again inhabited, and against the people gathered from the nations who have acquired what? Livestock and goods. You know what happened to the Jewish people because they were dispersed all over the world? Well, in fulfillment of what God said, he made them prosper wherever they went. And guess what? When it was time to go back home, guess what they took back with them, according to what Ezekiel says right here? They took back the best of everything they'd learned all over the world. Think about it. Some of the greatest scientists, some of the greatest doctors, businessmen, they prospered in the lands where they were in exile, and when they went home, they turned that barren wasteland into a first world nation that has nuclear power, that has a first rate military, that takes water out of the Mediterranean Sea and turns it into drinking water, that invented, according to our last guide, the cherry tomato. Okay? You read this chapter, what God says is, I will put a hook in their mouth and I will draw them down into this land. By the way, they're going to come up against Jerusalem and God's going to take care of business. Okay, you have to read the whole chapter. Israel's not going to have to draw a sword. They're not going to have to do anything. God is going to stop them. It's an incredible thing as you read it. But here's the sign. The continued hatred and attempted destruction of Israel based on Middle Eastern wealth. That's what he describes here. Who is the most hated nation on the face of the earth? Now think about this. It's not Iraq. It's not Afghanistan. It's not Libya. It's not, what was the one where Idi Amin was and stuff when he was in charge of that? What was that? Uganda. It's not China. It's not Russia. It's not North Korea. In this world today, for the most masses, there are two great Satans. One is the United States, because they hate us. Why do they hate us? Because we have stood by Israel. What is the one nation that has been put against it more, what's the term that they use where they vote against them in the United Nations? More than any other nation. Israel. What's the one little bitty nation that all of those around them have said in their own charters that they want to kill every Jew that lives and drive them into the Mediterranean Sea? What's the one nation? Why is Israel always on the pages of our newspaper? Who's Israel that they would have such a place? Even size-wise, it makes no sense. Size of the state of New Jersey. Who cares about New Jersey in here? Okay? You could fit 8 nations of Israel in the state of Arizona. 8 nations of Israel. Land-wise. And yet, one little thing happens in Israel. One little thing happens in Jerusalem. It's front-page news and the Jews are at fault. You have almost total annihilation of ethnic groups. in Uganda, in Darfur. And when you very, I guarantee you that most people have no idea what Darfur is or what it's about. This is an incredible time that we live in. And one of the signs is this sign that he speaks about here, that continued hatred, the continued attempt to of the destruction of Israel. That is a sign that God has given us. Now, I don't even know what the hook is that God's going to put in the mouth of these enemies. I have no idea. There are some people that think that Israel someday is going to find oil. It's going to be one of the biggest oil things. There's some words that speak about the pits and stuff down by the Dead Sea that they think they may find something someday. I have no idea what that's going to be. But it's going to clearly be a hook. I believe it's going to be an economic hook. And they're going to come against Israel. And they're going to attempt to destroy it. You say, Pastor, isn't this Armageddon that Ezekiel's writing about here? I'm telling you, this is not Armageddon. Depending on the prophetic teacher that you read, some believe this will happen before the rapture, or some believe it will happen immediately after the rapture. But it's not Armageddon. Okay, Armageddon is yet to come even after this. But supernaturally, God is going to spare Israel when all the enemies come around him. It's a sign for us to understand that the continued hatred and the attempted destruction of Israel is part of God's prophetic message to us. The fourth sign. Go to 2 Timothy. Chapter 3. And I want you to know, these are not all the signs, but these are the signs that have to do with economics. That's what we're talking about here. Okay, so these are economic signs that help us see that. And so you say Paul in Timothy actually deals with some economic issues? Does he give signs? Yes, he does. 2 Timothy chapter 3, look at verses 1 through 5. But know this, that in the last what? Days. Perilous times will come. For men will become lovers of themselves. Lovers of what? Money. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, thank you. I brutalized that word, right? Brutal, despisers of good. Traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its powers, and from such people turn away. What you see here is Paul speaking about the priority that you would see rather than on spiritual things, rather than upon a godliness, more would be on material things. The priority of life would be on what you can acquire, what you can have. It would be on money, lovers of self, lovers of pleasure, lovers of all these things. We would turn literally into a hedonistic society. Not just a society, but a hedonistic world where I must acquire, I must have. I prove my worth by what I have. I prove that I'm important by what I have. The priority for my existence is to gain things, to gain money, to gain wealth, to gain power, to have economic advantage over other people. And Paul says to the young pastor Timothy that in the last days, this would be the indicator of what the world would be like. The priority of money in the minds of men, the priority of material things in people's minds. And even within the church, we find ourselves, if we're not careful, pulled into this. Got to have. Everybody else has, I got to have. Everybody else has, I deserve to have. There are some people within the church that evaluate themselves against other people by what they have. Not in the church, of course there are. There are some people in the church that have always been there. If you think about James's writing, that consider people of wealth to be more important than people who do not have anything. James warned the church about that. If you'll remember, he says, when a person of wealth comes in, what do? You say, hey, come sit at the most important seat. Come sit at the place of prominence. When the poor person comes in, what do you say? Well, find a chair wherever you can. Just don't get in anybody's way. So the philosophy is that people are more important to us, and ultimately, even if the church, if we're not careful, more important to God and His kingdom because they have something that someone else does not have. This would be the picture of the way the world would be. And again, I would say to you, the church has not escaped this type of mentality. We must always check our hearts to make sure that we don't evaluate one another by what we have or maybe what we don't have. That we don't judge one another by those things. Because if we do, then we've fallen into that trap, that deception, that people are only worth what they have. Yet you understand this. The richest person in this room could lose everything they have in one instant. So what does that mean? If our philosophy is, if you don't have, you're not worth it. So that person, that one time had this great place of prominence because they had everything and we exalted them out of that. They lose everything. What do we do to them? Do we kick them to the curb? The world would do that, wouldn't it? We need to make sure that when we see people, we see them as precious souls. Precious souls that are not evaluated by what they have on the outside or the sides of their bank account or what we think they can do for us. But every soul precious. And the Bible warns us we need to be very careful because we may even entertain angels unaware. Anybody here ever entertained an angel unaware? Don't tell me you have, because if you were aware of it, it wouldn't be unaware. Okay? You don't know. I don't know. What would an angel unaware look like? I don't know that either. If I knew that, I'd point them out to you. But it'd be like God to test our hearts. To find out if it would be the kind of person would be the most difficult for us to deal with would be the angel. And later on in heaven you're saying, oh, it was you. Paul warns that one of the signs that we're coming to the end of time is that things become the priority. Economics become the priority. We've lost a sense of what is actually valuable. You ever think about what you want to leave your kids? I wonder how many in here have already made plans to leave our kids an inheritance. I don't see anything wrong with that. But what would be the greatest kid? You're saying Jill's not getting anything?
No.
Okay, good. I told my dad and mom, I said, you spend it. It's yours. You spend it. And they did. They took my advice. What is that? It's not wrong. If God has blessed you in that way, to leave that inheritance for your kids. But if that's the most important thing you leave your kids, you've missed the mark. If the most important thing we leave our kids is some money in the bank or some property and stuff like that, we've missed the mark. Can't take any of those things to heaven. And your kids can't either. But you know, you can take your kids to heaven. You can leave them something very important. The world is turned upside down to where people think that their value is found in what they possess. And as incredible as it seems economically, we've so flipped the world upside down that you're evaluated even today by the debt that you have. You may have first-rate car, you may have first-rate stuff in your house and stuff, and you may not actually own any of that. It's on your credit card. It's on some loan that you have. But somehow, because you have it, and think about it, you don't really have it. You evaluate yourself as, I'm doing pretty good. I'm not like my neighbor. He only owes $30,000. I owe $130,000. I'm doing pretty good. A priority of money and material things. The last sign I want to give you tonight. Go to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17, verse 26 through 30. And this is Jesus speaking, and here's what he says. As it was in the days of Noah, so also will be also in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, They were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and a flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so it will be on the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Two examples that Jesus gives what it's going to be like in these days. And basically, what is he speaking of here? You really have two of the most, you might want to say two of the most graphic major judgments recorded for us in the Old Testament. The flood, you can't get more drastic than that. Everybody died. Regardless of what they say on the Discovery Channel, everybody died except for Noah and his family. It wasn't a regional flood, it was a worldwide flood that destroyed the earth. Okay? The other judgment, the judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah. What happened? These people had become so wicked, so contrary to God, they had defiled themselves spiritually, they had defiled themselves intellectually, and they certainly had defiled themselves physically. They were so horrible that you couldn't find 10 righteous people in both these cities. You couldn't find 10 righteous people. And so God sent, remember, the angels to get Lot and his family out. But, and then the fire of God fell upon those. What had happened? What's the sign that Jesus is saying? It's going to be like that. The sign is very simply this: indifference. Indifference to the warnings of God. I've given you four signs that are based on economics. This last one speaks of an attitude that touches every area of our life. When a people become indifferent to God's existence, God's word, God's judgment, that is a people that is beyond reaching. Now, that's not for me to determine those people individually. But if Jesus says, when a people become so indifferent that they cannot be reached, that's when God, just like it was in the days of Noah, those people couldn't be reached. They wouldn't listen to God. They wouldn't follow God. You had Noah 120 years building the ark, and at the same time preaching to the people God's judgments about the fall. And they thought he had lost his mind. This guy's building a boat out here in the middle of the desert. What's he doing? He's crazy. Oh, crazy Noah down there building a boat. What happened? That day came, he shut the door, and not only did the rains come down, but if you read the scripture, the water broke up. It killed all of them. Noah wasn't so crazy anymore, was he? Nobody listened a lot. He tried to talk to those people in that community. Do what's right. And they said, well, who are you to tell us what to do? When we get done with these two guys, we'll start with you. We'll finish with you. Complete indifference to anything godly. We find ourselves there today. For the most part, we live in a society, and it's almost worldwide, it's a universal thing, where people have very little, if any, consideration of God. Romans chapter 1 is being fulfilled all around us. Where the creation has got, where those who are created have gotten to a place where they worship the creator instead of, excuse me, the creation rather than creator, and God has handed them over to their own reprobate minds. And those with a reprobate mind will do anything. That's what he says. They'll do anything. And everything, even that which is completely unnatural. Where's that come from? It comes from a people who have no fear of God. No fear of God is indifference. Indifference to the things of God. I don't know if the world has ever seen a time, except for maybe these two times that he gives us. Sodom and Gomorrah, localized. Noah, worldwide. Where the indifference toward the things of God so permeates every culture. Every people. Nobody cares if God exists. And if you don't care if God exists, you don't care what God says. And if you don't care what God says, you're not worried. You're self-deluded, but you're not worried about any of His judgments. So while they laughed at Noah, they'll laugh at us. Peter told us that in his epistle. They're going to mock you. They're going to laugh. They're going to say, "Where is this one that you keep saying is coming?" They don't realize that it is this one's patience and love for them and His will that none should perish that He hasn't come yet. But He's coming. He's coming. And we live in a time when we can see the fulfillment of the prophetic words. We're there. There is nothing that stands in between us and Him. And when you look at the economic situation, it's not good, folks. You think it's going to get better? See, I talked to some Christians that, well, if we elect so-and-so, if we elect... I'm telling you, it's not going to get better. It's not. It is built upon a fallacy. And it's only worth what you're willing to make it worth. Or even what the government's willing to make it worth. But when governments crumble and when people's lives fall apart, what are those pieces of paper in your pocket worth? These are signs that He gives us. Now, the good news, and I'll close with this thought. It's news I want to give you. I gave you at the beginning. Jesus has told us these things. God has inspired His prophets to share with us these things. So that we as His people, regardless of what generation we find ourselves in, whether it be an early generation who could not even comprehend how these things would come to pass, or in our generation where they are already, it's already possible that it can happen, that we put our trust in Him. That we don't become indifferent toward the things of God. That we don't forget that God has called us to walk in Him and His righteousness. That we do not spurn and mock that which is biblically true. But we keep our hearts close to Him. And His promise to us is that if we do that, if we have that relationship, He will keep us. And when He says He's going to keep us, that doesn't mean we're not going to go through hard times. Our economy could crash and it would change. It would devastate a lot of our lives in the way that we've been living it. But by the same token, we don't know what God might do in our hearts. If we got to a place where we could put aside all these things that we've made the treasures of our life and say, you know what? I don't have anything else. I've got to follow Jesus. I will follow Jesus. First century church, that's what happened to them. They lost it all. God used them to turn the world upside down. Can't tell you what's going to happen. Can't tell you when these things are going to happen. Can't tell you if it's going to be pre-trib rapture or if these are going to happen after the rapture. Can't tell you because He doesn't say that. These are signs of the time that we live in. But our God is able. And I want to say to you and I, we need to learn to trust Him now. Because a wake-up call when it begins to happen, it's going to be hard for us to trust Him then if we can't trust Him now. I ask you to bow your heads with me tonight. And I want you to take just a moment to do this. Would you take a moment from your relationship to God just to thank Him that He has not left us in a place of ignorance, that He has actually shown us what is going to take place. And because He's shown us, He intends for us to be prepared in Him. That wherever this world goes, He's going to supply our need. He's going to take care of us. He's going to be there. He'll never leave us, nor will He ever forsake us. That's His promise. Father, I thank You for Your eternal love. And though in my own feeble mind, Lord, I can't understand at all sometimes why You do what You do and why certain people have to go through certain things, but Lord, I want to learn to trust You more in these things. And You tell us that these things are about to happen. And we see that these things that You had Your prophets speak of 2,000 years ago from a perspective that they could not comprehend, the kind of technology that they were even talking about. But you inspired them to write these things, and we see it. And these are signs to us, Lord. First of all, that your word is true. Second of all, that we're in this time. And then, Lord, I think it's a call to us for your people to come back to trust you, to stand in the security that's found in who you are, Lord, and not what we have, nor the promises of what people say we could have, but ultimately in you. So, Lord, find a people here that have a heart's desire to put their trust in you in every area of our life, from our families to our businesses to our finances to our eternal security. Lord, thank you for the promises we have. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.